Okay, super, super. Yes, good morning, everybody. I'm David Pearson, and I'm the mediator, coordinator for the Cambria Fire Safe Council. No, Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group, pardon me. That group is a group of all volunteers who work to make Cambria a safer place to live, to contain a wildfire. We meet the second Wednesday of every month at 3 p.m. If you would like to join our group, you can sign up on the sign up sheets outside, or you can send me an email. My email is david.pearson, P-I-E-R-S-O-N, .usna@gmail.com. This part of the event is being recorded and will be available on the website 24/7 NCEP, which is the 24/7 Emergency North Coast Emergency Preparedness. If you haven't been to that website, I suggest that you go out there. It's got just a ton of information on how you can prepare, not just for wildfire, but an earthquake, tsunami, or any other kind of emergency. We'll also be posted out on our Facebook page. Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group has a Facebook page now, if you would like to join us out there. And also on Slow Spam, since we have our gentleman from AGP here recording this and helping us with this event, they will be posting this recording out on Slow Spam as a special event if you want to watch it out there. This morning we will have speakers providing useful information on fire insurance, Cambria evacuation, home hardening, and a wildfire demonstration on the sim table at the end over here. During that sim table presentation, you can remain in your seats and not have to go over there, because we'll be showing all the information right up here on the screen, okay? You'll be able to see exactly what's going on the table. It'll be much easier for you to see it in your seats than trying to gather around that table, okay? Thank you. We also have exhibitors here who will be here until 1 p.m. to answer your questions and give you information. Please take some time to visit with them. We have CERT here, we have someone from an insurance company in the back, we have home hardening people here to talk to you. Okay, lots of good information out there if you can stop by after the presentations are over. We would like to thank at this time our partners, the SLO County Fire Safe Council, Cambria Fire Department, the CCSD, the CCHD, and the Cambria Emergency Response Team, or CERT. They've all helped us out organizing this meeting and getting it set for you. Our first speaker today comes from us from the diligent work of Taylor Hilden. If you know Taylor, she stays on top of things, and she was able to really help us out in getting this speaker set up. Ms. Westlake is going to go ahead and do her presentation, and during her presentation, for those of you that are Zooming in, you can use the chat function to ask questions, or if you prefer, at the end of her presentation, she'll be answering questions, and if you want to put up your hand, you can put up your hand and we will unmute you and allow you to speak. Otherwise, all the people that are on Zoom will be muted throughout the entire presentation, just to keep the background noise down. Okay, our first speaker comes to us, like I said, from the diligent work of Taylor Hilden. Sally Kim Westlake is an associate insurance compliant officer in the Community Relations and Outreach Branch of the California Department of Insurance. She has been with the department for 14 years, educating consumers about insurance, and has over 20 years of experience in the finance and insurance industry. She is responsible for coordinating outreach programs, developing partnerships with community-based organizations, and conducting presentations to educate the public. We are pleased to have her here via Zoom today, and she has promised to visit us again in the spring if we desire. Ms. Westbrook, all yours.
Thank you, Dave, for the introduction. If I can get Mary Beth to share our PowerPoint at this time.
Right now it's disabled.
Bob, can you allow her to share her PowerPoint, please?
You should be able to share now. We are seeing it on our end.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Again, thank you, Taylor, Dave, and the Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group for inviting us and making it possible to share our information via Zoom today. Thank you, attendees, for being here. And hopefully, as Dave mentioned, the next time we're invited, we can be there in person. Next slide, please. So under Prop 103, Californians can elect the insurance commissioner. So Commissioner Ricardo Lara was elected into office in 2019. Let's talk about the role of insurance commissioner. His main role is to protect consumers, by ensuring a fair and competitive insurance market, and to maintain insurer solvency through appropriate property and casualty rates, conducting market conduct reviews, resolving consumer complaints, and investigating and prosecuting insurance fraud, and also to enforce the insurance laws of California. The insurance commissioner can't make new law. Any changes to the insurance laws require legislation. The fact is, insurance is a for-profit business. California is the largest insurance market in the United States and fourth largest in the world, with annual premiums of $340 billion. Next slide, please. So let me ask everyone in the room. So if you had a total loss today, do you have enough insurance to rebuild your home? Your answer should be an astounding yes, I know the answer. But if you don't know, that probably means you won't have enough coverage to rebuild your home after a complete loss. Now, I've read various reports that indicate that up to 8 out of 10 homeowners are underinsured. So what does that mean exactly? Simply put, if you have a total loss, let's say from a wildfire, you won't have enough money from your insurance policy to rebuild your home. Did I get your attention now? Well, unfortunately, most homeowners don't know that they're underinsured until it's too late. They find out after they have a total loss and have to file a claim. Just imagine you've been paying your premiums every year for 20 years without questions, and to find out that you don't have enough to rebuild. Don't you want to know now before it's too late? Next slide, please. So now let's take a look at a typical homeowner's insurance policy, also known as a HO3 policy. So the homeowner's policy contains two sections. So this first section, one, provides property coverages, which is A, B, C, and D, while section two covers liability coverages, E and F. So we're going to break this down and let's look at coverage A, your dwelling. So coverage A provides major property coverage that protects your house and the attached structures if it's damaged by a covered peril. Coverage B is other structures. So this coverage provides protections to other structures on the residence premises that are not attached to the dwelling. So items covered include like detached garages, tool sheds, and et cetera. Coverage B is usually limited to about 10% of the coverage A limit. However, you can always purchase more coverage for an additional premium. And so this is something you want to work out with your agent or broker and insurance company ahead of time. So coverage C is personal property. So this coverage provides protection for the contents of your home and other personal belongings owned by you and other family members who live with you. Now, coverage C is normally 50% of coverage A, or is subject to an established amount agreed upon by you and the insurance company. Again, additional amounts of insurance can be purchased ahead of time. Now, you want to consider scheduling items separately or adding riders for items like jewelry, collectibles, antiques, other expensive items, personal contents that are in the home. Coverage D is loss of use. This coverage will help you with additional living expenses if your home is damaged by apparel insured against to the extent that you cannot live in your home. These expenses include but are not limited to like housing, meals, warehouse storage. Coverage D is normally limited to 20% of coverage A. In the event of a loss, it's important that you keep receipts of all additional living expenses and submit them to your company for reimbursement consideration. Now, coverage B is personal liability. This section of the homeowner's policy will provide coverage in the event you or a resident of your household are legally responsible for injury to others. Coverage E normally provides defense and will pay damages as the insurance company deems appropriate. There are some exceptions. The liability coverage will not protect you in all situations, such as an intentional act. So all of the exclusions and specific language can be found in your policy. Coverage F is your medical payments to others. This coverage pays for reasonable medical expenses for persons accidentally injured on your property. For example, if a neighbor's child is injured while playing in your home, the medical payments portion of your homeowner's policy may pay for necessary medical expenses. Medical payments coverage does not apply to your injuries or injuries of those who reside in your household. It's not a substitute for health insurance. Business activities are also excluded. All of the exclusions and specific language can be found in your policy. Now, there's specific perils generally covered and not covered by a homeowner's policy. Typically covered in the homeowner's policy if damage is caused by fire, lightning, windstorm or hail, explosion, riot or civil commotion, aircraft, vehicles, smoke, vandalism, theft, and more. Perils generally not covered by homeowner's policy if the damage is caused by flood, earthquake, earth movement, termites, water damage, mold, and the list continues. It's really important to know what your policy covers, but just as important to know what the policy excludes. Next slide, please. So let's look at this. Are you underinsured? Do you know if you are? You want to conduct an annual or biannual checkup of your coverages and limits with your agent or broker. Let's look at some of the reasons why you could be underinsured. Rebuilding cost is not the home selling price. Insurance buyers wrongly equate the limit of insurance with the home selling price. They rarely have an accurate estimation of what it would realistically cost to rebuild their house, but they can go online and see the selling price for comparable homes. Now, I've heard of a case where the selling price of the property, like on Zillow or one of the real estate agent firms, including the land, was determined to be about $650,000, but the actual cost to rebuild the home to code was $970,000. So think about when your home was built. Has things changed since then? It's probably safe to assume your city, county now has new building code upgrades that has to be used in building your new home. Building code upgrades can easily add 35 to 50% to the cost of rebuild. Remember, it's now mandatory to also put in interior sprinklers in the homes built in California. Permits themselves have tripled the cost in some cities in California. So following a disaster where large areas are affected, like in Paradise, construction costs soar due to lack of construction crews, materials, inspectors, and etc. So currently, it's estimated the area disasters are increasing building costs in California by an additional 30 to 35%. And the necessary time needed to rebuild has gone from 14 to 18 months to up to now 24 to 36 months, and in some cases even longer. There's also the cost of debris removal that you have to consider. This can be a very large expense that can take up a big portion of your coverage. I've heard of a case where the fire burned so hot, it damaged the foundation. And the price tag to replace the foundation that required that pilings be pounded into the slope added an additional $400,000 to the rebuilding cost. So think about, will my policy completely and totally replace my home if it's destroyed? Well, that depends on whether your policy is also a replacement cost value or an actual cash value policy. If the policy is an actual cash value policy, you're not going to have enough to rebuild. If you have a replacement cost value policy, maybe. Some types of replacement cost policies will pay your policy limits plus a certain percentage above those limits. And that could be the difference in being able to rebuild your home with all the additional unforeseen building costs. So what do you need to know leaving here today? Do I have enough coverage to rebuild? If you don't know the answer, then you need to talk with your agent. Ask your agent, if my house burned down today, do I have enough to rebuild? If your agent can't give you the answer, then maybe it's time to find another agent. No one wants to pay more for insurance. I get it. I know I don't. But I also know that if I have a complete loss from a fire, I have enough coverage to rebuild my home. Most importantly, you need to work with an insurance agent that understands your needs. Many agents will reduce your premium to make their rates competitive. Now, this is a double-edged sword because your coverage is reduced as well. Reduce your premium, you're going to get a smaller amount of coverage. Reducing premium saves you money in the short term. However, your limited coverage won't be enough in the event of a total loss. It's always important to look at considering paying a little bit more in premiums each year because you're securing your own finances and what that policy could provide to you in a dire situation. Now, when you talk to your family, friends, and neighbors, tell them they're most likely underinsured. They could be 8 out of 10 Americans that are underinsured. Get them to stop thinking about replacing the old house and start thinking about rebuilding the home with new regulations, new materials, higher labor costs, costly architectural plans, required demolition and debris removal, contractors' overhead and profit, and so on. Next slide, please. So again, Prop 103 gives Insurance Commissioner Lara the authority to regulate rate increases in property and casualty insurance. So the property rate increases are governed by law. Insurance companies have to file the rate increase with us and it has to be approved. The rates cannot be excessive or inadequate, but it can be higher for brush fire and wildfire areas. Insurers can generally choose where they want to write. Remember, insurance is a for-profit business. Insurers also must maintain eligibility guidelines. They have to be fair. The rate increase has to be specific and substantially related to the loss exposure within their underwriting requirements. Next slide, please. Now, insurance companies can non-renew for almost any reason that's risk-related, as long as they give you, first of all, 75-day notice and a reason for the non-renewal. So what do you do if you get a non-renewal notice? You got to know, time is not on your side. 75 days is not a whole lot of time. Because remember, if one insurer thinks you're high risk, there's a good chance other insurers will think the same. You're going to start by calling us and file a complaint. We want to make sure that the non-renewal you received was issued legally and timely. Call your insurance company. Ask, what can you do to maintain your current policy? Sometimes it works. Not often, but it has. Is there anything you can do? Clear brush around your home. Do you have a long-term relationship with your insurance company with multiple policies? Maybe you've never even filed a claim. Talk to your insurance company. Look at what the possibility is of you being able to maintain that policy. And it may only be one more year of that renewal. It may be short-term, but it can save you money and a lot of headache by maintaining that first policy that you currently have. Now, you also want to work with your agent and broker about shopping for another carrier. You want to let them know, hey, I got this non-renewal notice. What do I need to do? Help me find another carrier. If they come up empty, you're going to widen your search. Find an agent outside of your high-risk neighborhood and see if they can come up with a company that's willing to insure your home. Because each company has different underwriting guidelines, you might be able to find a company that's still writing policies in your area by working with an agent or broker that's outside of your neighborhood. Now, after a search with the admitted carriers, okay, within the regular insurance market, then you might have to consider a policy with a non-admitted carrier or a surplus lines policy. This means that the insurer has chosen to transact business in California, but to do so without being regulated by the department. They do still have to follow some rules set forth by the department, but they could charge more or sometimes less than an admitted carrier. So that's your possibility there, is to go with, again, a surplus lines carrier. Then, of course, the last resort is to go with the FAIR plan. Now, we understand non-renewals can seem unfair. There's no consideration of the individual tenure or claims history, no consideration of pre-fire mitigation and/or structure fire hardening, no change in your property risk, no clear statewide standards for a fire-resistant structure or mitigated property that will make an insurance company guarantee coverage. Homeowners don't know what their wildfire risk scores are to be able to mitigate their score and to find and keep their coverage. So again, insurance companies, we can't make them insure and write policies in a certain area. If they deem that they have too many policies in a certain given area and that's too much a risk for them, they can start non-renewing and stop writing new policies in that area. Next slide, please. So what can you do to keep your coverage before you ever get that non-renewal notice? Again, insurance companies can non-renew for almost any reason that's risk-related. So your claims history can cause a non-renewal. And even if you move from one insurance company to another, the claims history of that home follows you through your shopping process. Look at things that are under your control, okay? Things you can do to maintain your property. So when the insurer does an audit, it won't flag your property, which is maintain the condition of your property, check the roof, the plumbing, look for visible signs that need repair. Harden your home, clear brush away from the property, clean the gutters of any leaves, remove any flammable items stored on property. And you would think, especially attending an event like this, most of you, I'm sure, have done this, but there are a lot of people out there that don't take into regard some of the simple things they can to harden their home to mitigate a potential loss from a wildfire. Now, here's some things that you can't control. Of course, the location of your home, whether it's near brush or near a forest, and you can't control unclear brush on your neighbor's property. And most importantly, you cannot control the wildfire risk score that's been given to your neighborhood. Next slide, please. So let's talk about the California FAIR Plan. The FAIR Plan was established in 1968 following the riots and brush fires of the 1960s. They became the state's insurer of last resort, providing access to fire coverage for California homeowners unable to obtain it from a traditional insurance carrier. The FAIR Plan is not a state agency, nor is it a public entity. There is no public or taxpayer funding. The FAIR Plan is a syndicated fire insurance pool comprised of all insurers licensed to conduct property and casualty business in California. So if you can't obtain coverage in the traditional insurance market, the FAIR Plan may be a temporary solution. The FAIR Plan is a last resort option, and you should continue to shop for insurance in the private market every year. So again, even if you have the FAIR Plan now, you shouldn't settle for having and keeping the FAIR Plan for years. Again, they realize, we realize, it is a temporary solution only, and that you should continue every year to shop with an agent and broker to see if you can find a different carrier that provides a comprehensive policy to your home. So let's talk about the Fair Plan. It offers a standard fire insurance policy for both the structure and contents. This is a basic property policy that has coverage limitations. No coverage is provided for liability or coverage for other perils such as burglary. The Fair Plan Dwelling Fire Policy is a named peril policy which provides coverage only for damage caused by specific causes of loss listed in the policy. And the coverage limit is only $3 million for all coverages combined, for structure, content, additional living expenses. And this limit was recently increased from $1.5 million to $3 million by Commissioner Lara. And we know this limit may not be enough for a lot of homeowners in the wildlife urban interface areas. So currently, if you have a Fair Plan policy, then you would consider purchasing a difference in condition policy. This is a second companion policy to cover the other hazards, such as premises liability, water damage, and theft, making it a comprehensive homeowner's policy. So you have the Fair Plan that covers fire only, then you would have to purchase a difference in condition policy on top of it with a traditional carrier. And surprisingly, when you get that non-renewal notice from your XYZ insurance company, they'll say, you may want to consider, purchasing fire insurance from the Fair Plan. But we'd be happy to offer you the difference in condition policy because that's where there's less risk. So they want your business on the difference in condition policy, but not in the fire insurance portion of it. So good news is that Commissioner Lara requested and then order the Fair Plan to offer full comprehensive policies. He made this order again on September 24th of this year, and we are waiting for the Fair Plan to comply and make this a full comprehensive policies available to all their policyholders. This order is going to give approximately 200,000 Californians who currently have the Fair Plan to protect their homes with a more comprehensive option besides the bare bone coverage that the Fair Plan currently offers today, with basically higher policy limits potentially, as well as savings in their pocketbook, less premiums paid because instead of having to purchase two separate policies. Next slide, please. So let's look at what CDI, the Department of Insurance, and Commissioner Lara has been able to accomplish so far. We've been able to increase consumer protection for Californians. He's ordered mandatory one-year moratorium on insurance companies non-renewing or canceling residential property insurance policies after a declared disaster. What does that mean? So if you've had a total loss, if you've been affected from a wildfire in a declared disaster area, you automatically get a two-year protection of non-renewal or from cancellation from your current insurance carrier. But this one-year moratorium now gives protection to those zip codes, to those surrounding areas around the declared disaster area. And after a declared disaster area, the commissioner with CAL FIRE will come up with the zip codes that this moratorium will give protection to. And you can find a complete list. If you're in an area surrounded by wildfire, declared disaster area, you can get a complete list of those zip codes on our website at insurance.ca.gov. Okay. We've also been able to help homeowners to recover from fires and find home insurance. And we'll talk more about that later. We're able to assist homeowners in filing claims and maximizing their insurance benefits following a disaster. After a declared disaster, we have staff at all of the local assistance centers helping homeowners obtain their insurance copies of their insurance policies, as well as helping them file a claim with their insurance company, helping them understand what's next, what are the steps, what do they need to do, and what they can expect from the insurance companies on their part to help them process their claim, as well as coming to us for assistance. Also, Commissioner Lara and the Department of Insurance was able to get the Governor Newsom to sign into law in 2020 that's going to help cut the red tape for wildfire survivors by removing a company-specific form requirement for inventories, requiring advance payment of living expenses, giving grace periods for payment of premiums, and additional living expenses to be paid when a home is uninhabitable due to an evacuation order or lack of water or lack of power caused by a fire. Next slide, please. So going forward, here's Commissioner Lara's action plans. He's going to take the following actions as regulator of the nation's largest insurance market by developing home hardening standards that are consistent based in fire science and apply to all insurance companies. Giving transparency to consumers about their wildfire risk score and what they can do to reduce it. Insurance companies use these wildfire risk scores to determine which homes they'll write and what premiums they're going to charge. By creating also insurance company incentives, recognizing home hardening, mitigation of properties, and community mitigation actions, and requiring that insurance companies seek adequate and justifiable rates to protect the solvency of the market. Statewide standards for fire-resistant structure or mitigated property. How does this sound? If you harden your home to a set standard, shouldn't you be insurable? Shouldn't there be a benefit to hardening your home? So Commissioner Lara and CDI is trying to establish these standards and get legislation done where it's going to require insurers to consider home hardening as part of their rating and underwriting of residential insurance. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, insurance fraud exists. And after a disaster, there are scammers that come out that want to take advantage of these wildfire survivors. This can be unlicensed public adjusters, contractors, and so many more. So we will dispatch a team from our 400-member enforcement branch to any disaster site to prevent scammers from lurking around and trying to do business illegally and taking advantage of these wildfire survivors. If you suspect fraud or a victim of fraud, please report it. Call us. We can help. Next, I'd like to introduce you to our outreach team member, Mary Beth Bykowski, to tell you about the resources the Department of Insurance has to offer.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for being here today. At the Department of Insurance, we have a wealth of resources to assist consumers. We offer informational guides on all lines of insurance. They are available on our website, or you can have a hard copy mailed to you if you prefer. One that I want to highlight is the Home Inventory Guide. It is a workbook that you will need to fill out. Room by room, you should inventory and list every item you own in your home. Yes, it's tedious and time-consuming, but it will save you thousands of dollars and hours of headache if you do this now before you have a total loss. Why? Because your insurance company will require you to give them a list of everything you lost and want to claim. The more itemized your inventory list is, the more you can claim and get paid from the insurer. Next, our top 10 tips for finding homeowners insurance will guide you through the process. Sally has already mentioned some of the steps you need to take when faced with a non-renewal. By the way, both of these guides are at the reception tables today. On our website, we offer the Homeowners Insurance Finder tool. Just enter your zip code and it will list the insurance companies, agents, and brokers that may be writing policies in your area. And finally, the annual consumer complaint study. Do you know how your insurance company ranks? Every year, we report how many justifiable complaints are filed against an insurer. Don't you think it's important to know how your insurance company ranks before you have to file a claim? These are just some of the resources available to consumers at CDI, so please visit our website at www.insurance.ca.gov. If you have questions about your current insurance policy, a new policy, or if you've been denied coverage, a claim, or your policy has been canceled, or you want to report a fraud, please call our consumer hotline at 800-927-4357 or visit our website at www.insurance.ca.gov. Thank you for your time today, and I'll turn it back over to Sally for the Q&A.
Thank you, Mary Beth. So thank you, everyone, for being very patient and joining us today, both via Zoom and in person. And again, as I mentioned, I hope next time we're invited that I will be there in person giving you the information. I think it makes a difference being in person, but hopefully we're able to get as much information here today. And so I'm open to questions at this time.
If you have a question on the Zoom, people, you can go ahead and ask it in the chat or raise your hand if you would like. Is there anyone in the live audience here who would like to go ahead and ask a question? Put your hand up, please. Okay.
Dave, there was one question in the chat that says, where can I watch this later? Is it going to be on our website? Also, when are those meetings to join the fire preparedness?
Okay, Dan has gone ahead and answered those on the chat, but I'll repeat them here. This recording will be available on the website 24/7 NCEP. It will be available on our Facebook page, Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group. And it will also be available on Slow Spam under special events. We can also post it on the CCSD website if we get permission from them. I haven't done that yet. I think Chief Collinsworth can make sure we can get that done.
Thank you,
Dave. Yes, focus group meetings are the second Wednesday of every month at 3 p.m. We generally go for about an hour and a half at the most. And if you want to join, you can sign up here, see the people at the reception desk, and I will send you out an email every time we have a meeting and other information as it comes available. You can also go to the Facebook page and post on there that you want to join. And the other opportunity is to send me an email directly. My email, again, is david.pearson, P-I-E-R-S-O-N, .usna@gmail.com. All right. Any other questions? Yes, we have a couple questions here live.
Does all of Cambria have the same risk level or by house?
I don't know the answer to that question because it is your, it is CAL FIRE that determines the wildfire risk score for an area. But again, it's also, besides that, it is dependent on the individual homeowner above and beyond that as well. So depending on, they come up with their fire risk score by looking at various topography, cameras and things like that, but also how much the excess and egress in and out of an area, how much access there is, as well as the fire station, the capability, access to water and things like that, all those resources. So I am not familiar with Cambria's specific wildfire risk score. But in speaking with your Fire Safe District members, I understand that there are quite a few of you on the FAIR plan, which leads me to believe that you guys are in a higher fire risk score area. Have you been non-renewed? Has your premiums gone up?
Hello, Sally. This is William Hollingsworth, Fire Chief of Cambria. Thank you for the information. It was quite thorough, but yes, Cambria does have some different zones. We are listed on a fire hazard severity zone as either high or very high, depending on what part of the community you're in. And then we get calls on a regular basis to the fire station to clarify distance and staffing components of the fire department, what the water system is like, what the hydrant systems are like. And frequently when we answer those questions, people have been able to get insurance reinstated because there is an assumption on some insurance companies that Cambria is so removed, those things don't exist. Another component to that is giving them the ISO rating for the town. It's currently what we call 44X. Now that doesn't mean a lot to the people in here, but what they do in that process is measure everything from the defensible space components, the staffing levels, the equipment available, the water infrastructure, the roads, and distances of all of those to responding agencies. And as all of those things increase, that ISO rating can go down. Not every insurance company uses the ISO, but those that do, that can determine either rates or availability.
Thank you so much for that information. I think that's very helpful in that people understand that, see, insurance company can make mistakes. They are looking at a general overview, and that's one of the things that the commissioner disagrees with, is that they look at satellite imagery and say, okay, this whole area is considered high risk and we are not going to ride in that area. But when an insurer, insured decide, gets a non-renewal and challenges the insurance company and says, wait a minute, this isn't correct. That's why potentially the fire station is getting these calls asking about their water system. And some people are getting their homeowners insurance reinstated. So that's fantastic news in that this does occur in your area, because it does not occur in all areas. So thank you for that information. Dave, I have a hand up on, wait, do we have a hand up anywhere?
No, I think we have another chat question, Dan. Please explain extended coverage.
Extended coverage from, I think I need a little more clarification on that. Extended coverage on the replacement policy. If that's what I'm understanding, on the homeowner's place, it's called a replacement policy, but there's also full replacement policy, extended replacement policy. That means if the value of your policy limit is $500,000, you can basically up your premium, pay for an additional amount to have an extended replacement policy. And that number is going to vary, obviously, depending on your policy, but it could be as 25%, 50% above your policy limit. So your policy limit stands at $500,000. But because of all these other unforeseen rebuilding extra costs, your policy will kick in that extended portion of it, and they'll increase the policy limit by that 25% or 50%. Does that make sense? And so this is something you need to speak with your insurance company about. What kind of policy do I, if I have actual cash value, that means you're going to take the market value, remove the policy at the price of the land, and then take depreciation out, and that will never be enough to rebuild your home. Replacement policy, again, can be enough. There's extended replacement policy, and then there's also total, okay, replacement policy, which means there is almost no cap. But again, all those types of policies can cost more than what you currently might have. But again, it can be worth it. Talk to your agent, see what's in your financial budget to work on these details.
All right, thank you very much. We have another question on chat. How would you estimate the cost to rebuild? Are there any easy ways to calculate that?
Okay. So, every insurance company uses an algorithm, and they have their own underwriting criteria and their own modeling tools to determine after they take they talk to you about what your home is like. They talk about the roof, what it's built, what it's made of. And let's say they come up with, the insurance company comes up with a $250 per square foot to rebuild your home. I normally wouldn't just take that number from the insurance company because it is one model that they're using to give you a policy limit. I would be more comfortable in asking a potential even real estate agent, but more a contractor in your area and say, hey, Joe, what do you think it would cost to rebuild homes in our area? Maybe it's actually $350 per square foot. But again, on top of if there's a big surge, big wildfire, everything, price of everything goes up. Price of lumber, you can't find enough contractors. You can't find enough people to even help you rebuild. So all that increases, okay, price per square foot to rebuild. So again, I would do enough research and not just go with one insurance company's recommended rebuild price that they predetermined by a model.
All right, thank you again. We have time for one more question. Your slide mentions things you can't change to make your property safe. Are there any ordinances to help when neighbors' trees or land are potentially causing risk?
Okay, so there's some things you can do about your neighbor's potential wildfire risk. Right. And that would be is to talk to your city, talk to your fire department, talk to fire safe council, talk to and see and then talk to your neighbor, because maybe they don't understand the wildfire risk that they're potentially causing, that they're increasing by just not cutting down some tree, making it more safer. But there are, you know, organizations like fire safe councils that have a free tree trimming service. Maybe the homeowner doesn't understand that they don't have to pay out of pocket potentially. Maybe they can't afford it. Whatever reason, talk to your neighbor and see if there's anything that they can do, and then help them find a program. Help them find an organization that can assist in making your neighbor also harden their home. All right.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Great presentation by Ms. Westlake. Hopefully in the spring we can have her back and she can stay and answer questions afterwards and stuff. But for now, I think we're going to move along.
All right. So in closing, I just want to remind your viewers, the attendees, that the Department of Insurance is here to help. So Commissioner Lahr always touts that our consumer hotline number, the 1-800-927-4357. We have live persons, we have live officers like myself on the calls that are experts in the different lines of insurance that can assist you, and they will answer the call within a minute or two. After, you just have to press a couple numbers to get to the right expert, but we are there answering calls. You do not have to be in a on hold for hours on end. So call us if you have any questions, we can help. And remember, we have a wealth of resources available on our website. Please visit us at insurance.ca.gov. Thank you again for this opportunity. Talk to you soon.
All right, thank you again. Our next speaker is going to be Chief Hollingsworth, and he's going to give a brief update on what we're doing about evacuation plans here in Cambria.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for those that are being here, and thank you for those that are able to watch us. Again, William with Cambria Fire Department. It's a great opportunity to be able to discuss these things. They're very important to the community. They're very important to us. They're also very important to the CCSD. And I want to encourage, it's generally encouraging to know that during our last strategic plan update, there were four key strategic plan goals that were defined and added to the new process. And I want to relate to those to what you, relate those to you right now, just to emphasize that this is such a main focus of what it is we're trying to do and provide for this community. The first is updating our multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan. That's a cooperative plan between us and the community healthcare districts. The healthcare district is the agency in town that provides the transport services for the people that may be injured that need to go to the hospital. By having a plan that is joint in nature like this, what it has done is that it has identified existing hazards within the community, and then by having the plan in place, it makes us eligible to be able to apply for a lot of the grants that become available either through FEMA or through the state government agencies. So it's important that we keep that plan current and updated, and we can use that as a groundwork, if you will, to be able to look out for money from other agencies to help out our community. Another key component, because Cambria is set in the middle of this beautiful Monterey Pine Forest, is updating our forest management plan. So we're going to be looking at that coming up down the road. Obviously, that could entail bringing down some additional dead trees, trying to address things like bark beetle or other issues, cleaning out some of the understory, and even making additional defensible fuel breaks as necessary. We want to identify some additional evacuation routes out of the community, and I'm going to come back to that and show you how this has become such a major focus to what we're doing right now. And then really one of the big goals at the end of this is to develop a true defensible space ordinance for the community. Right now, we have a fantastic working relationship with Cal Fire, and between the two agencies, we try to address using enforcement tools from both the health and safety code and the public resource code to be able to mandate clearance in parcels that are either unimproved, something that doesn't have any buildings on it, or improved parcels, and those are those where your homes are. And so between the two of us, we have enforcement authority, but what it does is it creates these little voids and pockets throughout the community that we have difficulty in addressing. So if we can get all the groundwork done to develop a true defensible space ordinance that is overriding for everything within the community, we would be able to address some of those issues, just like the caller or the person that put in there, how do I address things that are on my neighbor's home that I can't necessarily make happen? So those are key things that we're looking at down the road. I talked about the fact that one of the key goals is our enhancing our evacuation routes. And what we've done recently is developed an evacuation ad hoc committee, which has members from our CCSD board of directors, the fire department, members at large within the community, because we understand that there's kind of two components to what we're talking about. We're talking about things that we can do within our community that can make us more safe, like making our forest safe or enhancing defensible space. But we might be in a position where we have to just say, okay, everybody, it's time to get out. And if we're going to have to issue that kind of an evacuation order, we want to make sure that we have that capability to get people out quickly. And so that subcommittee is looking at everything from evacuation routes, enhancing existing infrastructure. That might mean widening roads or giving us additional capabilities out of the community. And then looking at different evacuation models that might help us in developing trigger points. And when I say trigger points, what we're talking about is when we look at a fire that's coming from outside of our area. If anybody was around during the chimney fire a number of years ago and you saw the fire at night come over the top of the ridge, obviously that's somewhat of a daunting experience to be able to see that, and it looks like it's about that far away when you're looking at it at night. But when you realize that that's about 6 or 7 miles away, what we were doing in advance of that, myself and members from Cal Fire were going out and basically measuring based on anticipated fuels and wind and fire rate of spread, we can develop trigger points and say, if the fire were to come down and hit this spot, this is when we would issue an evacuation warning, or this is when we would issue an evacuation order. And those things are what we can help develop with some of those additional studies. We have a number of studies that have already been completed in town. There's still a few that need to be done. to have everything complete. They can be a little bit costly. We've been able to get a number of grants available through the Fire Safe Council with San Luis, and that's with Dan Turner. And we've been able to get some of those done with through professors at Cal Poly. We're still looking at trying to get some more of those done. And there's additional monies available through various grant opportunities that we're looking at, one of which I'll address in a minute, one of which I'll defer to Dan for him to explain. One of the other things is just getting the word out to everybody, and we're pursuing additional grants in this community in regards to communication. We have an aggressive reverse 911 system available through the Sheriff's Department that's automatic for all landlines. Those are your phones that are mounted in your homes, so that's automatically registered, and you don't have to do anything with that. We also have a very robust reverse 911 system that you can sign up with your cell phones. Now, that's not automatic. You actually have to go to the Sheriff's Department website and log your phone in there. But if you do that, you can get all of those automatic reverse 911 and update calls to your cell phone. So that's a benefit to you. We're also looking at enhanced communications for the community because, bottom line, if we've all been here long enough, you've probably been here when either the power goes down or when PGE now is proactively shutting the power down. We lose some of our communication abilities, and some of you are familiar with some of the stuff that is available through Diablo, and they have those sirens that go off in certain communities. That doesn't extend up to Cambria. That stops down near Cayucas. There's a possibility that we could put a similar type system in Cambria, that we could set up some kind of an audible alert system, that if it were to be activated, then you would be directed to go to a certain radio channel or Nixel alert system or some other type of information to be able to get what it is you need. All of those things cost significant amounts of money, and we're talking about multiple different grant opportunities to be able to address some of those things moving forward. One of the best things that we have going for us right now is that the county fire chiefs, all of the fire chiefs are in a large group in regards to how we try to uniformly approach just about everything in our responsibility areas, identified evacuation modeling for the entire community as one of the key things we need to address. And in doing so, we reached out to the Fire Safe Council and asked them to apply for a grant for Zone Haven. Is anybody familiar with what Zone Haven is? If you raise your hand, maybe three people in the room, and that's why we're going to talk about this real quick. Zone Haven is an online platform that is used by both emergency personnel and dispatch for the benefit of the communities as a whole. It does all the background modeling and creates evacuation tools that we can use that are uniform across the board. If we were to have an issue right now within the community, and based on that issue, I would issue an evacuation order because there's some kind of imminent danger, I can't just say, I need you to evacuate zone A1, because my radio, my dispatch is different from the dispatch from law enforcement on the sheriff's side. It's different from the dispatch from the law enforcement on CHP side. It's different from the dispatch that talks to the ambulance out there. Everybody has different maps because of the way the systems were built. What Zone Haven does is it takes all of this foundational information, puts it into one platform, it's uniform across the board, and now I could say, I need Zone A1 evacuated, and I need to say nothing else, because all of that goes out to the computer platforms for the Sheriff's Department, for CHP, for the ambulance, for the other people involved, and we have just saved an enormous amount of time for me not having to say everything north of Main Street, left of Cambria Drive, right of this. I don't have to create a box. I don't have to translate that information differently. Now, why that's important is obvious, right? We can streamline this entire system. We can't necessarily stop the fire from happening, but we can streamline the order system and make it happen much faster. And why that's important is because some of the evacuation modeling shows that getting everybody out of an area just like Lodge Hill in advance may take up to 4 hours. So the faster we could do things like this and streamline this process, the better for everybody in the community. It's one system used by all. It's universal. It can be used for training as well. And that's why we're so excited about that. The grant we were able to get through Fire Safe Council is for 3 years. It's about a $75,000 a year fee for this to happen. And so we're already in the evaluation phase of what happens 3 years from now. We're talking to the Board of Supervisors. We're talking to the San Luis County OES because both of them have a mission and mandate statements that they're trying to address things like that for the county as a whole. So we have really good opportunities to be able to pay for this in perpetuity. But Dan, would you be willing to address real quickly some of the stuff you and I just talked about the possibility of additional funding for Zone Haven?
Thanks, Chief. I'm Dan Turner. I'm the manager of the San Luis Obispo County Fire Safe Council. So those that may not be familiar with us, we're a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, not a government agency. And we have a board of directors, about 30 members that represent a real cross-section of the fire stakeholders in the county. And we have some members from Cambria around that board. Chief Hollingsworth actually represents the Fire Chiefs Association on that board. David Pearson represents the Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group on that board. And Bill Cochran is here someplace, I saw him earlier, is on the Cattlemen's Association representative on the Fire Safe Council Board of Directors. All county supervisors have representatives on the board. And so it's a very big cross-section. We try to get everybody's perspective and opinion. So that's who we are, what we do. We work countywide, and we work hand-in-hand with the Fire Safe Focus Group here in Cambria. So we have been successful, as Chief Hollingsworth mentioned, in acquiring a grant to purchase Zone Haven and get that implemented countywide. Those funds become available in January of this next year. So we'll be rolling that out in the next calendar year. Those are for grant funds from the state through the greenhouse gas funds or cap and trade funds, if you will, that are administered through the Air Resources Board and CAL FIRE. So we were successful in getting that grant. Again, that's a wonderful program. It's kind of becoming a statewide standard. We're excited about implementing that. We're also have some other grant funds to help manage the rollout of that. And then County Office of Emergency Services, I spoke with them yesterday, they're going to be applying for another evacuation planning management grant to help roll that out. So a lot of interest in the evacuation modeling and planning world because it's such a critical piece. As Chief mentioned, we helped facilitate some modeling here in Cambria a couple years ago in the Lodge Hill area. Some of you, I think, may remember that Dr. Nuorso at Cal Poly has developed a wildland urban interface evacuation model. It's unique, and most evacuation models are geared toward hurricanes and things like that. So this was specific to the wildland urban interface problem set. That one was a little frightening, if you remember. It was going to take 4 hours to evacuate Lodge Hill. So that helps us understand how complicated that is and what we need to do to work on mitigations. Also did East Village and West Village modeling. I think the area we have left is Park Hill and Moonstone, I think. So we have some funds that we believe we're going to secure. We'll know by Tuesday, actually, to finish that modeling for the rest of Cambria. So we'll have good ideas of what it looks like now. But then that gives us some guidance on what we need to do to mitigate that. How can we change that 4 hours to something more appropriate or reasonable? What does that look like? We can game play it with the models. What if we did this? What if we did that? What would that do to change the perspective? So a lot of stuff going on in the evacuation world, and more funds coming. So, turn it back to you, Chief.
Thank you, Dan. Excellent information, a little bit more eloquent, and I believe he defines things a little bit easier than I may because I see it one way in my head, but he's got some great background information. The modeling component of this is fantastic. The sim table that we're going to look at in a little bit is we're able to plug some of that stuff into because we're going to be able to define a specific region of a community. So we can actually build Lodge Hill on the sim table, simulate a fire from a certain direction, and then what happens if we lose one of our evacuation routes? What does that do for that modeling component, and how does that then change our trigger points on getting people in and out of the community? If you're interested in this, the City of Atascadero has already purchased the Zone Haven. It's already been in place for well over half a year. I would encourage you to go look at zonehaven.com. Z-O-N-E-H-A-V-E-N.com. And it's an open platform for you to be able to go in and see how the system is utilized. I think it's a good benefit for you to have a little bit more foundational understanding of what it is we're talking about. And we're excited about being able to roll that out. And as we have more information, we will definitely get it out there and pass it on. The last few components of this are what we can do as a community to really help ourselves. Evacuation preparedness. We're not spending a lot of time on this today, but there's a lot of information available through the 24/7 NCEP site that Dave Pearson indicated earlier. All of the checklists and things you might need to do to either harden your home or have go bags ready or just generalized preparedness for any kind of an emergency are available on that website. And I would encourage you to go check that out. We're continuing to work aggressively on the defensible space component. So one side of this is evacuation and one side is what we can do to our community. So again, we're looking at the possibility of some kind of a ordinance down the road. We're trying to expand our existing fire hazard fill reduction program, which applies to unapproved parcels. We work annually with CAL FIRE to get more inspectors in here to hit all of the improved homes. But again, there's some voids there that we need to address. The last thing I want to talk about real quickly is that I've used two different terms in here. One is an evacuation warning, and one is an evacuation order. So evacuation warning is something that if we have the ability to pre-plan something, we know that chimney fire is over the hill, and we've identified trigger points. There's going to be a trigger point where that fire progresses where we're going to issue an evacuation warning and say, because of the probability of what we see down the road, we probably will be issuing an order, which means get out. If I lived in this community, I lived here for more than 30 years, doesn't matter what community you live in, but if you receive an evacuation warning, you should take that in your mind as pack up and go. Get ahead of the group, get out, go to your friend's house in the neighboring community, get ahead of that, and don't wait around. If we get to the point of issuing an evacuation order, that is a mandate. It's legally binding. You have to exit the community, and that's when we work so closely with law enforcement and our CERT personnel. Again, a warning is this is coming, and an order is it's imminent now, leave now. And if we have to issue a warning because something starts immediately in town and we don't have that advanced warning, you can imagine the cluster that is going to occur on trying to get everybody out. If it's 4 hours just from Lodge Hill, imagine what it's going to be once we have to empty the rest of the sub-communities in Cambria onto that same highway. So I would take the evacuation warning, and this is what all emergency services people preach, the evacuation warning should be taken as a proactive step in your mind to go ahead and pack up and go. With that in mind, that's the last of the update I have for Cambria Fire and what we're doing. I'm happy to field any questions you may have. Otherwise, I'll turn it back over to Dave. Yes, ma'am. That's an excellent question. If you have the ability, okay, a good point. You asked if you issue an evacuation order, should you take both cars or if you could pack up in one car? Absolutely take one car. You have insurance for a reason, and hopefully it never gets that bad, but every additional car that's added to the road creates an additional time lag for everybody else. So it's convenient to have the two cars, but if you could put your family and your go bag in one, absolutely limit it to that. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Excellent question, Barbara. Yes. The question was, should you do anything in advance if you have the time to your home to protect? Yes, absolutely. So you should be taking proactive steps immediately, far in advance today, when there's no problem, right? You should be taking efforts to harden your home. If you have the ability to put on the non-combustible roof, non-combustible siding, change your landscaping to eliminate some of the fuels away from the home. But in advance of something that's coming imminently, there are things you can do. We ask that you actually leave your front door open so we can get in and further prepare your home if we're out there doing structure protection. We ask that you make sure that you have hoses with nozzles connected to all of your outlets on your home, because we can absolutely use some of the water on your home to put out little spot fires that are out there. If you have a ladder in your garage, go ahead and take the ladder out, put it up against the roof, because sometimes, depending on your roof style, obviously that can be a start of a point of ignition if you have a lot of accumulation of leaves and stuff in your roof. And then if you have the time, move other combustible stuff away from their home. People tend to put things like propane barbecues and other stuff right up because that's where they want to cook. Go ahead and take that propane barbecue and move it 20 feet away. If you store extra bottles there, take those away from the house, stuff like that. So there's absolutely things you can do. And some of those things are clearly defined on that NCPE site, the 24/7 NCB site. Good question. Yes, sir. So the question is, in lieu of a power outage affecting all communications, what do we do? And excellent question, and it's a question we have as well. We know for a fact that of the Shell cell towers around in and around Cambria, all of them are built with the emergency jack systems for them to be pull in portable power systems and plug in generators to make them work. But that takes time. There's only one of them that is set with a on-site battery backup, and for everybody's ease of mind, when you call 911, it doesn't matter what carrier it's on. It goes to whatever carrier is available. So you can be in an area, you have AT&T and there's a carrier, and there's no towers. If Verizon is there, your 911 call will go through. So that component will still work, but it's a fantastic, it's a scary question because we don't know all the answers to it yet. We have been working with the communication providers to get some of those additional things updated. They do have some capability in regards to enhancing the infrastructure of batteries and backups for them. But even the batteries, depending on use throughout the community, it might be an 8-hour battery. It might be gone in 2 hours because people are using it so much because every other phone is down. This is why we're pursuing some of the other communication and alert system grants as much as we are. We want to be able to possibly provide that alert, that radio alert system. You'll hear a siren, and then you go to a certain radio channel. And all of those are interconnected. So we don't have an answer to everything right now, but we've identified it as a problem, and we're definitely pursuing answers as best we can. I'm sorry I don't have something more specific for you. Anybody else? Yes, sir. Absolutely. I didn't want to get too much into the weeds of it, but however, it's a good question. You asked about enhancing Highway 1. One of the first things our evacuation ad hoc group, which is led by Director Gray, is to, we have at minimum two lanes on Highway 1. They happen to be going in different directions, but there's at least two lanes there. If we've gotten to the point of having to issue an order, we can streamline some of the evacuation by doubling the lane capacity on Highway 1. And so they applied for a grant, which we received and got a number of cones. I don't remember off the top of my head. And they're actually stored at the fire station right now. And between CERT and CHP, we would be deploying those cones to basically redefine the barrier on Highway 1 to double the lane capacity exiting, which does help. But remember that I still have to get, the emergency people still have to get resources in. So we can safely double the exit capacity outward and still leave a lane over on the shoulder to get engines and police cars and all that kind of stuff in. And that would help significantly. But our true limitation is we have one road. We have Highway 1. Now there's potential to be able to enhance that. There's potential to be able to add different exit points from other parts of the community, like another exit from Highway 1 from Lodge Hill, to add another exit from Park Hill, but all of it's going to the same road. So once you hit that, that's our limitation. So we have already had an assessment done by the state of California that was in a recent bill that was passed, and they're identifying single lane exit points from a community, and Cambria was absolutely on that list. Unfortunately, there's no monetary attachment to that to mandate some kind of improvement, but it's been identified, and we can use it as a justification for things we look at down the road. 24/7 NCEP, North Coast Emergency Preparedness.com. Any other questions? John, did you ever? Nope. Ma'am? Well, the key initially is that if we can get them all the way down to Highway 46, we now have two roads. So we could split traffic going south and east. So it's still not ideal. If you have more money than God, so to speak, and you want to pay for a doubling all the way down to Cayucas, that may help, but I don't think that that's going to happen in the near future. But that may be the very long-term solution that we need to look at something like that. Absolutely. Yes, sir. It is a possibility. However, resources going north are extremely limited. And in most scenarios, because of the fires that we really worry about, because of our prevailing winds and where a fire would probably start on the Cabell Ranch, we would probably want to exclude that because the fire is going to be coming that direction. And at one point, Barry could impede or compromise that evacuation route. So we don't want to send people to a location that is now either isolated or becomes more of a problem. But it really depends on where the incident is and what's happening. And remember, this isn't specific. We talk about this being a wildfire evacuation, and that's what we're talking about today. There could be scenarios where we're asking for evacuation for other reasons. We have a large earthquake happening here, other issues, flooding, tsunami. There's other things that happen that we may need to address that. All of those will pretty much mitigate and direct what course of direction we would be telling people. And rest assured, the intent is not to just say, there's an emergency, get out of town. An evacuation order is going to say, this is occurring, we're requesting, we're mandating that you leave, this is where you need to go. We're telling you that so we can have people there to offer further information and guidance, and that way people are kind of collected, and then you can disperse from that way. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. John's indicated the presence of Santa Rosa Creek Road, which is on the east side of town. You're absolutely correct. There is a load limit capacity on that road, not necessarily in weight, but in capacity for exiting. And that's an example of a road that if people have lived here long enough, you're familiar with it, you know it pops out on Highway 46, you might be able to bypass a big traffic knot here in town. One accident on that road is going to shut it completely down. And so it's absolutely an option. It might be something some of these grants can offer infrastructure improvements to make it even more sustainable. And bottom line, if it's the only way out, we're going to send them that way. But it really is dependent on the incident and what's there. But if you're familiar with the community and you know that, hey, I could get out on this way, or I could get to Highway 1 on the circuitous roads behind everybody else, absolutely use that to your advantage. That's institutional knowledge from living in the community, so that's good. All right, I think one more. Good?
Yeah, one more.
The question is, will there be officials directing traffic on the Highway 1? Ideally, yes. And we have limited law enforcement presence, especially in the case of an emergency that happens right now. We can get all the people in the world here if I have planning and time, and that's what all these guys will tell you. But if it happens now, it's going to be limited. It's one of the benefits of having a group in town like CERT, because I do have local people here that are committed to that. There's a little bit of a time lag for deployment there in regards to getting CERT involved. But the key that I need to remind you about CERT is I need to evacuate them too. Does that make sense? They're part of this constituency here, and they need to get out safely. So if we have advanced planning and we're talking about an incident that's coming to Cambria, absolutely, there would be people in place, and they would be guiding everybody out appropriately. All right, thank you, everybody. Dave?
All right, thank you, Chief. That was great. I would like to reiterate the cooperation that we've been getting from both the CHP and the Sheriff's Office on the evacuation planning that we've been doing. They've been proactive about it. They've been helpful, and they have limited resources. And you know that Mr. Stewart for the CHP is here with us today, and he came specifically at our invitation in case we had any specific questions for him. But you know, he talks about how few people he's got, and he's got this huge area stationed out of Templeton. And he said, you know, we're going to do everything we can to get there and help you evacuate the town, but it's going to take a little while to get all seven people to here. Okay, so you have to understand that, right? They're going to come, as he said, like blazes, okay? Sirens going and everything, but it's going to take them a while to get all seven. And as they come, they'll be deployed properly to help us out. So that's great. All right, next speaker is going to be Courtney Sanchez, an expert on home hardening. I think this is something key for you to be thinking about. There are a number of people. If you know Mike Walsh, he just had his house done, and he is a poster child for that program. So, Courtney, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Dave. I recognize the voice. Hello, Jeff. I may even know some of you, but with the face coverings, you'll have to pardon me if I didn't say hello to you. My name is Courtney Sanchez. I'm a project manager with Compass Building Group. I'm a second-generation county native. I've had kids that have graduated from school here and grandkids also that have graduated from local schools. So the community, this community, I've lived here, been building houses here since the 70s. And boy, how things have changed and how we build things. Something I was just sharing with my colleagues this morning, there's something about driving into Cambria, and here I am 60 years old, but since I was a kid driving into this town, there's something about it. It's a pretty magical place, nothing else like it in the county, but yet it's a volatile area, just like we've been talking about. You probably heard the phrase wildlife-urban interface law or code that the gal was speaking about from the state insurance office. Well, that code is an international code. We refer to it as, there's an acronym, WUI, W-U-I. I was introduced, there's a lot of, let me preface something real quick here. Thanks for saying I'm an expert, Dave. But let me tell you, there are some awesome contractors that I've been friends with for years that live here in the community. Some of them are smart and have retired, and I haven't. But I've been around this code since 1995, before it was even used in the United States or was called the International Wildlife Urban Interface Code. It has been adopted by the county in the mid-2000s, I believe. But before that, in 1995, I was introduced to this code in Kobe, Japan, after the Hanshin quake. I was there doing some, hired as a consultant working on the seismic end of things because they were rebuilding after that horrible earthquake there. But because of that earthquake, we never think about it, but the chief brought that up. Fires happen. You know, we're trying to get away from natural gas. We're trying to get away from some of these other fuels that can start fires when we have an earthquake. And he did bring that up. It's not just about fire, but things that can cause a fire. In Japan, we have there were narrow setbacks, just like we have here, 5 or 6 foot side yards. And your neighbor might be 10 or 15 feet away from you. So if their house catches on fire, what protects your house? Now, I look around several houses. There's several different building methods you see here, but you can tell the houses that were built before 2003, 4, 5. They have plywood siding, cedar shingles. They were beautiful at the time. A lot of maintenance, right? But it is so volatile when it comes to fire. It goes up, those elements go up very quickly. So with WUI, what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about ignition resistant building materials. Now we have several different types of materials out on the table in the back. You can come by, there's several handouts. But what does that refer to? What we're referring to is everything that's on the exterior of your home, which would include the roofing materials, the venting, because your house needs to breathe. So you might look up on you have a gable type roof, you might see a big gable vent. If you go underneath and you're walking in your eaves of your house, you're going to see a bunch of little holes drilled where you're blocking, so you get your attic breeze. If you're on a raised foundation, you're going to see little square vents that allow that attic space to breathe so that there's no mold, especially living in this climate. Well, what do we do? Well, there's vents now, venting that's been manufactured or created that will close up when heat hits it to prevent, and the chief can attest to this, a lot of these fires start and you never see them. Things are flying around, the embers are flying around, they get up into that attic space, and there's a fire in there before you even know it. And it's very hard to get out. That's why they end up opening up the roofs on a lot of these, just to get into there so they can vent it and they can put the fire out. So what do we talk about when we're talking about fire hardening a house? Well, it basically is everything on the envelope again, like I said, and it's a system. And when I say it's a system, it's all the different elements, which include venting, windows, even the windows. Many of you don't see a lot of new construction. Many of you are looking to renovate your house. Well, if you're going to do a window replacement package, that window company better know that this code, the WUI code, applies to Cambria with the county. So anything that's being built here or renovated, all these elements are going to have to be used, including the decking materials, because they do not want anything that is a volatile fire source next to your house. I'm not going to get into the code. You can look it up online. You can read through it. It's very, very comprehensive, but it will answer a lot of your questions, and I can answer your questions. I have business cards. If you want to call me anytime, I could come and look at your place and help you out. We have Hardy Siding. It's a cement-based product. It's fire-resistant. Windows need to have at least a 20-minute rating. Your doors, exterior doors, also must have a fire rating. Like I said, your deck material, your roofing materials. I have some handouts for some different roofing materials. They have to be a Class A rating. The insurance gal was talking about benefits and insurance benefits. I can't answer any of those questions, but I'm sure it's maddening living in the area you are and dealing with the insurance companies and trying to get some discounts because it looks like the insurance commissioner is trying to figure out a way to compensate people who are fire hardening their houses. That's what it sounded like to me, that they're working on some of that, which would be great if there were grants involved and help with expense. Is it cheap? That word, I think you can only use the word cheap when you're talking about how things are made nowadays, because nothing is cheap, right? Everything costs, there's a cost to it. Some of you live on hillsides, and there's a cost there because we have a safety factor in having to scaffold homes. We got to protect those who are working on those sides of those hills. Stucco is another great option, but some of your houses, we'd have to have an engineer look at that before we start adding that weight to your house. You're talking a couple pounds a square foot with some of the siding or less, siding options. When you're going to stucco, you're talking somewhere between 7 and 9 pounds a square foot. So you're talking about shear and the structural integrity of your home. If you're, granted, stucco is cement. It's going to be great. It's going to be a great fire preventer. But there is, like I said, there's a cost. And if you wanted to go down that road, we can line you up with an engineer to do a site visit. As far as what we do, I'm not here to sell work. Like I said, I'm just here because I love this community very much. And I think you all live in a just a beautiful place. And there are, you're not the only ones that fall under this new code. And I say new code, it's been around for a while, but there are other places, Tascadero, portions of Templeton, portions of Paso Robles, that fall under this, east of Arroyo Grande. So this wildland interface code applies to a lot of different people. You're not being singled out. It's just that the county has implemented this to help you help your houses survive anything, especially a fire that could come through there. So if you have any questions, I have business cards. I don't know if I can answer everybody's question, but I'm more than willing to meet you and see what your conditions are. And I have several products and handouts out there that you can grab. And thank you for your time, Dave. Thank you. Appreciate it. Oh, so I have business cards there. So I'll just hand if you want to contact, and if not, I forgot we're on Zoom. My phone number is 928-925-0106, or you can email me at csanchez@compassbuildinggroup.com. Thanks, Dave.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Mr. Sanchez. Last speaker is going to be really exciting because we're going to light up the simulator table over there and show you how fires progress. So Dan Turner will be coming up and leading this. Remember, stay in your seats because you'll be able to see it right up here much better than if you try to get around that table. Okay, we got a camera looking right at that projector and everything. So stay in your seats and you'll be able to see. I think they're going to start out with the Paradise Fire. Oh, okay. You're going to do an update on grants just real quickly before that, but then we'll get to the fun.
Thanks, David. Dan Turner back again. So David asked me to give you a little update on some of the projects in Cambria that we're working on and then some of the other grant processes that we're doing. So in the evacuation world, there should be out front, you guys should be able to get copies of these evacuation current plans. These were a Fire Safe Council project. Kind of gives you some guidelines on evacuation preparedness, what to do before, during, and after evacuation. So you know, take advantage of that. They're out front, out in the parking lot out there. So other grant programs that the Fire Safe Council was recently awarded two grants to do fuel treatments across the county. The total is right at $5 million for those two grants. Those funds will come available again in January of 22, and we'll be continuing to do work throughout the county, including some work up here in the North Coast. The major project that we have been working on for quite some time now is on the Covell Ranch, which is the northeast part of town here. And Covell Ranch, for those of you who don't know, is the largest stand of Monterey pine owned by a single ownership in the world. And it's about 1,100 acre property, about 685 acres of Monterey pine. And Mr. Covell has been working with a large collaborative group on how do we take that forest from its current condition, which is incredibly unhealthy, and restore it back to a healthy status, much like what we would have seen in the 1700s, 1600s, things of that nature, before we decided to come along and stop fires, and we decided to build towns in it, we decided to do a whole bunch of things that kind of pissed it off. So that's what we're working on. So that collaboration is the Fire Safe Council. This is the Fire Safe Focus Group here in Cambria. It's CAL FIRE. It's the Upper Salinas Los Tablos Resource Conservation District. It's the Nature Conservancy. It's Mr. Covell. We've developed a operational plan for that forest as to what we intend to do treatments over the next 10-year time period, funding availability, obviously. And then that same process would apply to other properties in the area up here. This is a This is a first-time process. So we have developed a project under what's known as the California Vegetation Treatment Programmatic EIR. So it's a statewide programmatic EIR that has been certified last year, and that's the basis by which the permitting process goes forward. Very, very detailed. The plan that comes out of that project, specific plan, is 240 pages long. It details exactly what we will do on the treatment of that property. We have engaged 12 forest scientists and licensed professional foresters in the development of that plan, 5 biologists, about a hack sack full of fire subject matter experts. So we think we've attacked this thing from every possible angle to look, make sure we're doing environmentally sound methodology, that we're doing the right thing for the forest health. And we're pretty happy with the outcome of this. So what's the status on that project? So it is the project specific analysis, which is the plan, will go before the Coastal Commission next Friday, 15th, for consideration by the Coastal Commission, because this is in the coastal zone. So that'll be before them. If you want to, it'll be a Zoom meeting if you want to Zoom in next Friday. I think it's item 21 on their agenda, so it'll probably be toward the end of their day. Once Coastal Commission acts, if they approve the plan, then it'll go for certification to the state. Once they certify it, we would be allowed to begin operations under the conditions of the plan. So that's happening. Operations could begin this fall on Corbell Ranch, and the areas that would be we would work on first, because broken into multiple treatment areas, would be the area west of Bridge Street, kind of bounded by Happy Hill, Pine Knolls, East Village, and Bridge Street, if you can visualize that. So that would be the first operational area. So that's a project that's going on. Again, I mentioned we got 2 grants through California Climate Investment Greenhouse Gas, roughly about $5 million. We also received this year 2 grants from PG&E to do fuel treatments, $180,000 in grants from PG&E. And then we were just awarded this last week another grant from PG&E for $100,000, one of 5 in the state that they issued, 5 in the state. San Luis Obispo County was awarded one of those, and it's to help encourage more public outreach, to coordinate with our fire safe focus groups. We have 17 fire safe focus groups in the county. So it's a matter of how do we engage with them, how do we empower them. That's our purpose, is empowering them to get action done. So that's kind of an update on grants and what we're doing. Anybody have questions related to that? Yes. So if I understood the question, is could operations begin fall of 2021? And then the second part was? Yes, it's very realistic. So our understanding is October 15th, again, it's Coastal Commission. That's kind of the final step in the process. Except for what's called the certification of the plan. The certification of the plan, once Coastal Commission takes their actions, it's about a 5-day window to get the plan certified by the other state agencies that have to do that. So we've been in contact with them, and we believe that would happen. So the modifying criteria on beginning of that would be weather. You know, in that if it rains, please. That would impact our ability to do work because of the ground moisture, soil saturation. Absent rain, we could begin work, you know, November 1st, as an example. So, but that's, pardon me? So the question is, what's the name of the plan? So the legal foundational document, the CEQA document, is called California Vegetation Treatment Programmatic EIR. So it's a statewide programmatic environmental impact report. And then that gives the permitting authority statewide and sets all the environmental guidelines. And then within that, you have to create what's known as a project-specific analysis for the site you're working on. And in that site, you look at the vegetation, you look at the wildlife, you look at the soil conditions, all the environmental conditions specific to that site, and develop an operational plan for that. Covell Ranch. So that project-specific analysis is for 680-ish acres of the Covell Ranch. So Happy Hill, Pine Knolls, Lemert Track, East Village, all share a boundary with the Covell Ranch behind all of them, correct. So it's kind of a dual component project. Adjacent to the homes, we'll be doing a defensible space shaded fuel break to protect the homes. The balance of the forest will be a forest health project, so it'll look a whole lot different than the fuel break does. So the key is to try to restore the forest to a healthy condition. It's got all kinds of issues with dwarf mistletoe and gall rust and pitch canker. It's not had fire in it for years, and Monterey Pine actually likes fire. It's adapted to fire. It needs fire, frankly, to reproduce effectively. So we've stopped letting it burn. Historically, it would have burned about every 30 to 40 years before we started doing intense fire suppression. So there's a huge buildup. If you've walked or gone through, you know, some of these forests here locally, it's pretty decadent, overgrown and dead. We've seen what happens. We know what happens. The similar stand of Monterey Pine in Santa Cruz County that was actually in better condition than this one was burned completely last year. So, where can you see a copy of the plan is the question. So if you go on Coastal Commission website, the whole plan is there on their website. Item 21, I believe it is, of their, they have a three-day agenda, so it's on the Friday, October 15th agenda. Any other questions about grants or projects? Okay, so let's talk about SimTable. So SimTable is what we're going to give you a demonstration of. SimTable is a computer-generated modeling of fire behavior. And it's a fairly sophisticated model. And it allows us to take a look at a specific community under specific weather conditions and see what a fire would do under those conditions. And you can visualize it. So you're going to be able to visualize it up here. The SimTable itself is sitting over here by the stage, and it gives you a sense. So we use some of the things we talked about in the evacuation model. We said, okay, how long does it take to evacuate an area based on the road network, the number of people that are there, those things. That's one component of it. We also want to look at what would fires do? What's the predictable fire behavior in those areas? For example, if a fire were to ignite here, how long would it take to get to there? You know, Chief Hollingworth mentioned the chimney fire that was, you know, 5-6 miles away. How long would it take the chimney fire to get to Cambria in, you know, a set amount of time under certain conditions? How long warning do you have? If you have an area that requires 4 hours to evacuate, you need to have that trigger point 4 hours in advance of that, right? Otherwise, you're going to be behind the power curve. So you need to know where those four-hour boundaries are. Well, what about fires that don't originate 4 hours away, that originate in the community? So what we're going to show you is three models, three representative models. The first one we want to show you is how this process was developed, to kind of give you a background on SimTable. So we're going to show you the Paradise Fire. It's a campfire in Paradise, California. So it's about a 6 or 7 hour window time from when the fire started until 6 or 7 hours. And what you'll see is this fire started east of Paradise. Those are familiar with the River Canyon. And it burned into the community of Paradise, Concow, Magalia, and down toward Chico. Paradise is a much larger community than Cambria, probably 20,000 people, if I remember right, two ways out. of paradise. Skyline Boulevard, which is the primary, goes down to Chico, and there's another goes down to Oroville. There's a mass evacuation, and those evacuation routes got compromised. So that's what you'll see, and Nate Herring's going to run this for you, and I'll point out some things if we can get the video to switch over there. Okay, so this is what the table looks like. So literally what we're able to do is overlay a aerial photo of the community, and we're going to do this for Cambria, we'll overlay a photo of Cambria. Nate, if I could get you to point out where Paradise is on this. Yeah, so that's the town of Paradise right there. And then the fire originated, if you look to the upper right there, that's where the fire originated. And the winds were blowing from that corner down toward the bottom left-hand corner. They're very strong winds, north winds they get in that area every year, very predictable winds. Except this was late in the year. This was in November. Normally in November, they've had snow up there. So when they get those winds, they've already, fire season's over because it's rained significantly and had snow. This particular year, drought, climate change. What climate change has done is it's broadened the width of the dry season, so it's raining later in the year than it used to. So this was all dry. So what we're going to see here is we're going to do a run on the Paradise Fire, the campfire as it was known. From where it originated, it's roughly 6 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know if you can see. Right there is a time stamp. I don't know if you guys can see that or not. This is really going to run about a 6 or 7 hour time window. So, Nate, if you're ready, he's going to start that. And if you just watch that upper right-hand corner, it'll move slowly. You can see it moving now. So this is a fire that's several miles away from Paradise when it originated. And as fires typically do, it starts relatively slow.
This is about 1 hour and 40 minutes into it.
If you'll notice, there's spot fires starting to occur out ahead of the fire. Those little dots, Dave, maybe you can point to some of those. I think about an hour or so after the fire originated, they started doing evacuation warnings. But as you notice here, the fire's already spotted. Again, that some of the spots are in Paradise. Oops. There we go. A couple of miles. It's not uncommon for fires to spot a mile or two out ahead of it, but depending on the type of what's burning. If you're burning in heavy brush or in timber, they'll spot a mile or two out ahead of themselves. Grass doesn't tend to spot as much as heavier fuels do. Yes, the question was, what do I mean by spotting? And what I mean by spotting is as these plants burn, they generate embers. And those embers caught in the wind fly downwind with the wind, land in flammable areas, and start new fires. Those are spot fires. So it's essentially the fire has, it's not just the leading edge of the fire that matters, it's where are these spot fires occurring. And these embers are occurring by the millions. It's not like one or two, it's millions. And when Mr. Sanchez was talking about your homes, that's what ignites homes is embers. The flying embers way out ahead of the main fire, hitting places on your buildings that are ignitable, hitting things in your yard that are ignitable. You know, things that can catch on fire very likely will catch on fire because these are arriving by the millions. The stronger the wind, the bigger the embers. The stronger the wind, the further the embers fly. So that has always been the concern for the fire professionals is the embers.
Hey, Dan.
Again, the stronger the wind, the larger the item is that can be picked up and carried off by the wind. So the larger they are, the longer they'll burn, and the and sometimes the greater the distance that they'll fly. So these embers are not like you see coming off of a campfire, little things that kind of wisp off. And they can be as big as your hand. They can be like pine cone size, very large pieces that are projectiles. So again, depending, I think if I recall right, in this fire, the winds were about 60 miles an hour, which is 10 miles below Category 1 hurricane force. So in my previous life, I dealt with a lot of these fires and dealt with many of them that approached hurricane force winds. So you can get very large pieces of material on fire flying through the air. They'll break windows, they'll do all kinds of things. So embers, it's all about embers. You want to be cautious. And I call them fire burglars. They're trying to figure out every way they possibly can to get in your house. So look at your house and see, where could a fire burglar get into my house? If you took a garden hose and sprayed your house, if water got in, embers will go in that same spot. So what's in there that's ignitable? Under garage doors, around garage doors, in vents, open windows, through screens, under the house, as Mr. Sanchez mentioned. You know, those screens are all designed to keep mice out and birds out. They're not designed to keep embers out when those homes were built back in the day. So look at those and think, how big of an ember can get through these screens or these openings? What's there that can ignite as a result of those screens or those openings being there? The building you want to create, you want to seal it up. It's an envelope. Seal it up so that it does breathe when it needs to, but also you can keep embers out. So where are we at now, Nate, time-wise?
We're about 2 hours into it.
2 hours into this, and the fire's well into this, into the town of Paradise. 2 hours. Seems like a long time. It's not a long time at 8 o'clock in the morning. Remember, this fire started at 6 in the morning. So it's now 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, one thing really to take a look at here is where it's spotted on the other side of town, right here. And watch the progression of that. Because it's now, it landed in a canyon, and now it's going to burn back uphill.
And if you notice where that is, I mentioned there's two ways out of Paradise. That fire, that spot fire, that's well on the other side of town now, is along Skyway, which is the primary evacuation route out of Paradise. So that evacuation route is now compromised. The fire that's burning down to the bottom is now compromising the other evacuation route to Oroville. About 18,000 buildings burned in this fire in 6 hours. The question was, did Paradise have a plan for evacuation and prepared? They did. And they had actually enhanced Skyway Boulevard to increase the carrying capacity. But moving that many people that fast, this is what we call a no-notice event. This is like, go, go now. And so you get everybody moving at once. Ideally, we would have notice, so you could evacuate by neighborhoods. You could stage that evacuation, make it. So you're not jamming everybody onto those roads all at exactly the same time. So the entire town of Cambria, entire town of Paradise has now been, is involved in the fire. And Nate, where are we time-wise now?
We're at 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Now burning up into Magalia, which is up at the north. It's coming down into Concow, which is here on the south east side. You'll get down into Yankee Hill, go all the way down to all the way down toward Chico. So as, and we can stop that. So as Chief Hollingsworth mentioned, with our law enforcement partners trying to amass enough resources to get in here to manage the evacuation process and the time involved in doing that. This was 6 hours of time frame to do that. Between the sheriff and CHP and their other law enforcement partners, being able to amass enough law enforcement officers here to effect an evacuation in 2 to 3 hours, pretty limited. Tomorrow, the next day, we're good. Same thing with fire resources. Tomorrow, the next day, not too bad. Today, there's 2 fire engines in Cambria. It's the Community Services District fire engine, and there's the CAL FIRE fire engine. We've done modeling here on what can the fire resources do in that first few minutes. What happens if they can't stop the fire in the first few minutes? Where are the next resources coming from? They're coming from Cayucas and Paso Robles. Then they're coming from Morro Bay, and then they're coming from Atascadero. And it's like pebbles in a pond. You're shrieking further and further and further out. You can amass 1,000 fire engines in here tomorrow or the next day. What can you do today in the time windows that were most critical about? Yes. Yeah, the question had to do with Hip Camp and the Airbnb of campgrounds, if you will, and the discussion about creating those here and elsewhere within the county. So yeah, that's an important. Building codes, fire codes, laws are always behind what's really happening. So can you keep ahead of those innovative changes? You know, people are incredibly creative as to things they can do. And the codes and laws always tail behind that. So part of the process is, what are we going to do countywide about this type of, this type of process? So it's a good question. Nate, are you ready for model number one on Cambria? Any other questions while Nate's, yeah, perfect. And the question is, some of the evacuation modeling, even in this one, I believe, discussed going down to like Marine Terrace, areas like that, going to the ocean. So you're trying to find a place of safe refuge. And a lot of that has to do with what's the problem? What's the threat? Where's it coming from? What's it likely to impact? And that's what the Chief Hollingsworth here, the CAL FIRE folks, the law enforcement, sheriff, GHP, and so forth, will try to identify where are places of safe refuge. Can you shelter in place? Shelter in place is an option if it's safe to do so. Can you go to a place of safe refuge rather than trying to evacuate all the way out to Morro Bay or completely out of the area if you don't have time? So those are all going to be situational based on what's happening right now. But remember, you're trying to find a place that's less likely to burn. And even if it does burn, it's going to be less intense. The intensity of the fire is going to be reduced. So one of the things that we know is when forests like this Monterey Pine Forest burns, you can't be within a quarter mile of that. The heat is so intense. It will burn you if you're within that close. It's an incredibly intense heat. So you want to get away from those types of locations. You can get to a place that's bare, the high school, for example, surrounded by grasslands, principally. You've got lawns, you've got large parking lots. the Hearst Castle Visitor Center, things like that, where you can get to a non-flammable areas, might be places of safe refuge that are plan B, because plan A of getting out of the area is not available. So look at that. Look in your neighborhoods for that. 10 city potentially, but 10 city's pretty flammable, actually, even though it's made of 10. Just drive in there next time you go into Boney's Tacos and look at those buildings and how many crevices there are that embers can get inside those mini storages. What's in there? What's in those mini storages that could burn? So you also need to be concerned about what is on fire and what am I smelling? What am I inhaling in the smoke that's burning? You know, vegetation burning, trees, brush, grass, natural vegetation is troublesome. Man-made materials that burn are toxic. So you have to be very aware of what's on fire. You got to pick your poison, if you will. There's a question back here. I'm going to be a little bit flip here. You don't need to worry about that. You'll be dead before that. So from the heat and from smoke inhalation. So you're not going to need to worry about oxygen deprivation. Shelter in place is risky. Shelter in place is kind of a last resort, much like the FAIR plan in the insurance world. It's because you can't reach a place of safety. You're much better to go to a place of safety. Leave early. Prepare your property. Be prepared yourself. You know, I can't emphasize enough Chief Hollingsworth's comment, Sheriff's, register your cell phone on the reverse 911 system. Do it. Do it today if you haven't done it. Because you'll get that notification from your property even if you're in San Luis Obispo. You can register other important addresses to that. I have a 94-year-old mother-in-law. I have hers registered on my phone. So if there's an evacuation notice or some notice that comes out, I know that. I get notified of that. So critical things like that. So you get those notifications. If you're not at home and you have a 12-year-old child at home and that notification comes in, what are you going to do? You have pets at home. What are you going to do? You have livestock. What are you going to do? Well, think about what would happen if I needed to do. What can I do to prepare for if I needed to do? Not at the risk of scaring you, but the purpose of this is to make you think about it, to plan for those potential. You know, we're working really hard to make that not happen, so you don't have to do that. But we know stuff happens. So, you know, you can do more than anybody else to prepare yourself, your family, and your property to be resilient to the impacts of either fire, flood, earthquake, any of the hazards that we know we are exposed to here. Yes, sir. Well, to some degree, we have a much milder climate here, you know, so, I'm sorry, the question was, should we take a census of security, I guess if that's the right term, is it false security because we live right here next to the ocean, or is that in fact, you know, not true? So we do have much milder climate here, so the number of days per year that a serious fire can occur here are less. Compared to, say, Paso Robles, or, you know, where it gets 110 degrees or and so forth. Clearly, the number of days are reduced, that exposure. But it only takes 6 hours. It only takes 2 hours. It only takes a few hours for these events to occur on those 1 or 2 days. So I personally experienced In my career, fire at Oakland Hills Fire, we watched 3,000 buildings burn down in about a four-hour time period. One day, 4 hours, in one of the most urbanized locations in the world. So resources weren't a problem. It was just you couldn't stop it because of the wind. So, and that's right on the bay. The Ana Nuevo stand in Monterey Pine in Santa Cruz County sits right on the ocean. The Pebble Beach stand in Monterey Pine, which also burns, sits right on the ocean. So for us to believe that because we're on the ocean, we're exempt from this, we have fewer days of exposure, but we do have days of exposure. So it just takes a small window of time for that to occur. Question. So the question, the comment was about the Woolsey fire occurred just immediately after the Paradise fire, within hours of it, in Los Angeles County, and burned all the way to the ocean. The key common denominator to all of these is wind. You look at all these catastrophic fires that occur in the state, it's wind. They're wind-driven fires, principally. We're seeing a little change in that now because of the amount of massive die-off in our forest because of bark beetle drought-driven impacts. But wind is almost always the common denominator. If you live in areas where you get significant winds, never getting wind here, get significant winds, that is risk. And so if there's flammable vegetation and wind, that is the deadly combination. So, we got one more question here, then we'll run the camera. Yes, so the comment is the ocean may not save your structure, but it may help save your life because you have a location you can go to take shelter from. Correct. Because again, that's that location you can go to that not likely to be as flammable. You have a greater chance of survivability. And that's your number one priority, obviously, is to survive this, to then worry about your insurance. So we have two prevailing wind problems in Cambridge. Question is, what direction are the winds most concerning here? We have two prevailing winds, the northwest winds that occur almost all summer. And depending upon where a fire ignites under a northwest wind, it's going to drive that wind, that fire that direction. The wind's going to steer it. And then in the fall, we get offshore winds. We get that originate east of us and blow toward the ocean. Those are the two winds that we're most concerned about here. And we actually have two models that will show you fires burning under both of those conditions. That's what our model is. So, Nate? We can get the, okay, so the image we have up here is of Cambria, and you should be able to recognize it. The Lodge Hill is kind of in the lower right hand. Highway 1 is the yellow ribbon that runs through the middle of the map from the upper left corner to the lower right hand corner. And Nate, which one is this one? Okay, so this fire is going to originate off of Highway 1 in the Lodge Hill area. And Nate, if you can maybe just point to where you think that fire is going to originate, right there above around Fern Canyon, if you're familiar with where that is, along Highway 1 right away. And this would be under that northwest wind model that we spoke about. So arsonist Nate is going to light the fire. So this model takes into account the terrain. Fires burn uphill faster than they do downhill, and the wind. So those are the two major factors, and what's burning, the material is burning.
Right now you're at about 6 minutes, and you got 8 acres.
It's approaching Burton Drive, right there. There's a little white symbol on Highway 1. I think that's about where Burton Drive crosses. And we've been doing a lot of fuel work on the Highway 1 corridor through there, the Caltrans right away on removing French broom. It's incredibly flammable, invasive, noxious plant to help reduce the fire intensity in there. Our goal is to get it so that these two fire engines are able to put this fire out before it reaches any significant size, before it outpaces them. Again, because the next ones are quite a ways away. So this is showing without any suppression action. So the model, the sim table model, allows us to also simulate suppression action. What would happen if a fire engine were to interact here, or a helicopter or air tanker or other suppression features? But this is an unaffected fire other than just what it would burn naturally if left alone. The wind is blowing from the upper left corner toward the right, so it's a northwest wind. So the map is north, or the map is oriented to the north, the top of the map, and west is the left side of the map. So think of the wind coming out of that northwest corner up there where that little green dot is.
It's 30 minutes.
Yes. And that's probably terrain driven, because that's Highway 1 where it goes through there is in a valley. That's kind of a fairly steep range. It's likely to spot across. So the challenge is here, Nate, can you maybe pause that just a second? So the challenges here, again, are the two fire engines that are here. They're going to be trying to deal with this fire. They have houses that are out ahead of this. They're going to be trying to effect an evacuation. You have limited law enforcement. There may be how many deputies here at that time? One, maybe zero? Yeah. Use the mic right there next to you.
Oh, I'm sorry. So so our units are going to be coming in. There's going to be efforts to door knock in the affected areas. If the time isn't sufficient there, we'll do PA announcements and siren alerting to get people's attention. That's called route alerting. Obviously, if we can get some more robust public mass messaging systems in place, like the siren to go to a certain radio channel to listen to, those are things we want to get in place. But there are ways, and we will use everything that we can in the time allowed to make sure that you're notified that it is an imminent emergency and it's time to find a way out of town or to one of these safe refuge areas. So at about 45 minutes, I'd say we'd have 8 or 10 units on scene with more coming.
Right.
Yes. Sure. They're going to join the effort.
They're going to call out all the folks.
Right.
They can muster.
Sure. And then CHP is bringing in units to focus more on those traffic control elements to keep everything moving smoothly.
And keep in mind, this is a team effort, so the law enforcement sheriff is going to be trying to do evacuation assistance on notifying folks to evacuate. CHP is going to be working on traffic, trying to streamline that traffic flow out of town based on that plan they have developed. Fire folks are going to be trying to either put the fire out or get out ahead of it to try to protect structures and help with that evacuation too. There's just a lot of things going on here in the very first 45 minutes of this incident. They're stretched pretty thin. 45 minutes in, they would have started to receive assistance from Cayucas and Paso Robles in about 45 minutes and probably have aircraft overhead, either helicopters or air tankers. So it's a very coordinated process, but the key is to try to get ahead of it before it reaches the point where you can't catch up. You're just always behind the power curve. And that's when you see these large fires. That's the situation. They got behind the power curve. Fires burning faster than they're able to do anything about it. So we can start that again.
Yeah, the winds are a sustained 19 miles an hour out of the northwest.
Pretty typical afternoon wind here in Canberra. Part of the situation is that drainage funnels the wind. You know, just gets oriented directly northwest along Highway 1 through that section. It just funnels the wind. It's like water going through a narrow creek. It accelerates.
And this model doesn't take into effect spotting right now, but we would likely have spot fires occurring out in front of this in the neighborhoods. That's causing the fire to get larger as they grow into the main fire front. So we're at 1 hour after ignition, and we're at 27 acres.
This is much slower spread than the Paradise fire that we looked at before, but it's all a matter of where it is, what's in the path of the fire, we'll show an east wind here. That's the next model. Yeah, again, wind driven and slope are the two main factors. So a northwest wind would push a fire to the south and southeast. And then there's slope in that area coming out of that drainage off of Highway 1. So it would burn uphill into that area, as well as the wind assisting it. So they both of them combine to drive the direction. There's a question back in the far corner. Yeah, so the question is, that area has only one exit because Burton is cut off. So you have primarily in Lodge Hill, you have Burton Drive and Ardeth. Drive are the two main routes that intersect Highway 1. It's interesting that they cross. So that's a critical link. Should an accident, not that any accidents ever occur during evacuations, but should an accident occur at that intersection, that creates a very critical problem because now you've compromised both ways now. The one over to Park Hill. So the question is, when would they open the lower Fiscalini Ranch fire road? I imagine you're talking about the one from Marine Terrace to Park Hill. Chief Hollingsworth, probably the best one to speak to that. Back here behind it. She says, Chief Hollingsworth said that would be incident driven and availability of somebody to go do that. Yeah, so, but that would be another way out in this model, because that road is off to the west. So you could exit, if you're out of Marine Terrace area, you could exit out through Park Hill through that alternate route that's out there. It's gated. So that gate would have to either be opened or compromised.
So Dan, we're an hour and 40 minutes in and Ardeth Drive is starting to be impacted at this time.
Yeah, so the fire crossed Ardeth now in the lower section there. At an hour and 45 minutes. How long did it take to evacuate Lodge Hill? 4 hours. This might impact that. So we're also getting fire starting to go up into Ramsey area on the other side of Highway 1 and along Burton up to the other side.
Number
So the question is, surely with the amount of this fire and spotting, it would move faster. Spotting, again, as we mentioned earlier, is really the culprit. So it's likely this would spot out ahead of where, again, the wind is going to be the major contributor to spotting and how far out ahead it spots and what's on fire. So in this particular area, we have quite a bit of Monterey pine and some shrubs in there that generate a lot of embers. So we would likely get spotting. The other spotting culprit that creates more embers than anything else is the burning building. So when the buildings start burning, they generate even more embers and contribute to the spotting, and they also contribute to house-to-house fire spread. So as Corky mentioned, Kobe, Japan, the close proximity of houses to each other, or if you're within 30 feet of your neighbor, if your neighbor's house catches on fire, it's likely to catch yours on fire, just from the radiant heat alone, but also potentially flame impingement. So what you have is a vegetation fire that's now converted to an urban combination urban vegetation fire. That's the wildland urban interface. That's what that means. You have not only vegetation burning, you have built environment burning. They're contributing to the entire fire problem. Yeah, turning off the gas is a good idea. Now, Chief Hollingsworth mentioned earlier, I almost fell off my stool over there. He said, leave your front door open. And I'm sure he meant leave it unlocked. Don't leave it open. That's a 3-foot by 7-foot window for embers to go in if it's open. So leave it unlocked. Remember, seal it up as best as you possibly can. If you have shutters, close them. You know, you have operable shutters, close the shutters to keep things from embers impacting the glass. I'm talking about shutters outside. So keeps if you have them in, if it's lightweight flammable curtains, don't, because they'll, radiant heat will ignite them through the windows. If you have like metal aluminum shutters, close them. Pretty lightweight. They could potentially ignite from radiant heat. Remember, the heat is incredibly intense. Glass is not a particularly good insulator. Single pane glass, not a particularly good insulator. Transmits heat very well. Those of you who have fireplaces with glass doors on them, does the heat come through? Sure it does. So it's not a particularly good insulator. So if you have very lightweight, flimsy window coverings, they could ignite easily. So open those up. Remember, your job is to try to keep embers out and heat out, intense heat out of your house, outside the envelope or the envelope of your building. Keep it outside. Remove all the burnable materials from around immediately adjacent to your house. Your trash cans, those lovely plastic trash cans that embers can land on the top of, melt through the lid, and drop down inside. What's inside of there? Everything you own that you want to burn, because you can't burn anymore, so you haul it off, but it's all burnable material. Get those trash cans away from your house. Get your patio furniture away from your house. Anything that could ignite, get it away from your house. Okay, so how are we doing time-wise here?
We're about 2 hours and 50 minutes, almost 3 hours into it. Almost the entirety of Marine Terrace is going to be cut off here in the next few minutes from evacuating out to Highway 1, other than going up through the Biscolini Ranch.
Okay. So have you seen enough of this one? Okay. Now this is a model. And one of my other part-time things I do, I'm the director of the Wildland Urban Interface Institute at Cal Poly. So we study this stuff at Cal Poly. And one of the things that's a truism about models, all models are wrong. Some are useful. Okay? So what that means is that it just gives us an inkling that under these conditions, this is what we would predict could happen. It's not an absolute. So, but it gives us a sense of space and the likelihood of occurrences. It gives us an opportunity now to go look at what could we do about that? How could we mitigate that problem? What could we do to change that outcome? And that's what, you know, the evacuation modeling is about. That's what the fire behavior modeling is about. That's why we have building codes that, you know, Mr. Sanchez spoke about, to make those buildings ignition resistant, so they're less likely to ignite, less likely to contribute to the problem, less likely to create undesirable consequences. So we're going to run, and Nate's going to take us on another journey here. Let me know when you're ready there, Nate. Okay, so the second model run is under east wind conditions, offshore wind conditions, more representative of what we might get in the fall tomorrow, for example. We should experience some of that in the weather forecasting. So this fire occurs out by the high school off Santa Rosa Creek Road, out adjacent to the high school area, and it's under northeast wind. So the winds are now burning, or excuse me, the winds are now blowing toward the ocean in this model. So the high school, if you point the high school out there, Nate, that's the high school. Your head's in the way. That's the high school right there, Santa Rosa Creek Road, Main Street, and again, Highway 1 is this yellow ribbon down here on the bottom part of the screen. It's the Covell Ranch is the forested area up toward the top of the screen with the road with the dog leg is Bridge Street. That helps you reference where you are. Bridge Street goes out to the cemetery. We're ready. So arsonist Nate is going to fire ignite right there. Again, this is different conditions. That's grassland out there. There's some slope up towards Scott Rock area. Those are all going to affect the way the fire burns, the fire behavior. Right now, it's principally driven by slope. It's burning uphill towards Scott Rock. Grass burns a lot faster than trees or shrubs. It's not, yes, correct. Grass burns faster, but it's less hot. Doesn't generate anywhere near the amount of embers, either as the heavier vegetation types do. Easier to control the fire, significantly easier to control fires in grass than it is in the other. Yeah, question is that Bridge Street. So the white strip through there that's got a dog leg in it, that's Bridge Street. Yes, Bridge Street is a public road, county road, and it goes from East Village, there by Lynn's Restaurant, and it goes up to the cemetery at the dead end of the road. At the cemetery. Yeah, the cemetery is just off the map, or just off the image up there. So Pine Knolls, Happy Hill are the areas just to the south and west of the forested area there, again, the Covell Ranch. So how far are we into this now, Nate? 30 minutes?
And 18 acres.
18 acres in 30 minutes. Correct. The wind's going to stay steady on this. Again, it's a model. We can change it. They have the ability to go in and do some adjustments on it if you wanted to change it. And the winds do change, by the way. It happens all the time. So what you're seeing now is the influence of slope is becoming less important than the influence of wind. What's our time marker in acreage now?
We're at just about an hour and about 50 acres burned. So right now we have Main Street and Santa Rosa Creek Road. That intersection is involved.
Right about Fog's End Ranch, if you're familiar with where that is. Question is, what's the difference in the colors? It's just time. So the model changes. The yellow is the leading edge of the fire, turns to orange or reddish over time. Doesn't have to do with intensity or anything else. It just kind of gives you a sense of the time progression. Yeah, again, the question is, what happens if embers are ignited a fire somewhere else? It's a new fire. It's another problem. Either you combine it in the management, you either combine it in the operation, or you have to treat it as a separate incident. It needs attention. You know, many instances, what fire managers will do is let the main fire burn into it, and not get, you don't want to get caught between them. That's a bad place to be. Yeah, the Santa Rosa Cemetery, the healthcare district offices, that fire's right adjacent to them. It's where the school was moved to on the other side of Main Street there. The middle school, you point the middle school out so they have a reference of where that is. There's the middle school in Tin City. Somebody asked earlier about Tin City. Tin City is, can you point that out to them, John? 10 cities right there. So now the leading edge of the fire is just about to reach Bridge Street. So it's burning on Covell Ranch as well. There's a fish and wildlife property in there, a fish and wildlife reserve of about 100 and some acres. It's right above the healthcare district office. It's burned most of that now, and it's now burning into Bridge Street area and Main Street in the East Village. And it's now coming across Main Street on the south end, again there where the Santa Rosa School is moved to. So at this, the question is, who would be evacuating? So the folks that evacuation warnings would be issued to would be folks out ahead of this. So Pine Knolls, Happy Hill, the Lodge Hillside, east of Highway 1 would probably be under evacuation warnings. The area of Main Street, Bridge Street, the middle school, I'm guessing, so not if I'm, tell me if I'm off track here, Chief, would all be under evacuation orders because there's imminent threat to them. Probably the entire East Village area of Main Street, along Main Street. And then Happy Hill and Pine Knolls, well, at this point in time, they're probably under evacuation orders, particularly Pine Knolls. And the fire's relatively close to the middle school. So remember, you have to take into account how long does it take to evacuate something. You know, single family residence, if the people are home, they can leave in relatively few minutes. The middle school, what's the methodology to get all those students out of there? What's the time involved to do that? Or can they shelter in place? You know, what's the plan for them? The elementary school is not that far away. So if you have to evacuate the middle school, the elementary school, what's the time period involved in doing, and the logistics involved in doing that? You had a question, yeah. In this instance, going north is probably a good option. Again, it's situational. It's where's the fire? What direction is it burning to? And are there other alternative pathways out? And Highway 1 north, say to the visitor center, Hearst Castle, is a good alternative in my view, looking at the situation right here. Go early. Avoid the rush. Seriously. The earlier you can go, and the chief mentioned that if you get an evacuation warning, which is the lesser of the two, treat it as an order. If you can go, go. You're gonna be safer yourself, and you're going to reduce the confusion and the congestion with an evacuation order. But it's all a matter of time. How much time? Where are we now, time marker?
We're at 4 hours and about 300 acres burned.
Yeah, so 4 hours in. So remember, 4 hours in, the entire community of Paradise had been impacted by fire. So this fire is moving slower, takes into account where we are and the conditions that exist here. And we're not under 60-mile-an-hour winds. So it's more representative of the locality here. But 4 hours in, there's a significant part of this town impacted. It's all relative as far as the size of the fires and what the consequences are, what's being impacted by that. Yes, sir.
I live outside of town, and the biggest danger for the Panhandle type fires coming in is at night. That is happening. Mm-hmm. And so this is looking kind of slowly compared to what it could be. Mm-hmm. We had a real wild kind of Panhandle come on.
Correct. And you guys that live here know that. You know those winds. You experience them, you know, all the time. Pay attention to where they are blowing and what the situations are. Correct. So I'll give you an example of another fire that, and a lot of these fires do burn at night. And the complications are geometric, the fires that occur at night, because you don't really know where they're at, for one thing. They look like they're here, but they could be literally somewhere else. You just don't have the fire managers don't have a good sense of where those fires actually are. People are not as aware. People are not as mobile. They're not. So you have just, it compounds the problems when those fires occur at night. The Tubbs Fire, which is a fire that occurred in 2017 in Northern California, started near the community of, Cloverdale, that's not right, Calistoga. In the upper Napa Valley, started in the middle of the night. By daybreak, it was into Santa Rosa, burning houses in Santa Rosa, okay, under those kind of wind events. So that's several miles away. So again, you're planning, you should be thinking about that. If my evacuation route is compromised, where would I go? Is there a place of safe refuge I could get to? Can I go to Marine Terrace? Can I go to Shamble Park? Can I go to a place that, by the virtue of the fact that you're there, your risk is reduced significantly? That's what you're looking for. You should have that in your plan as to, I have the way I go in and out of my property every day. That's all well and good. What's your second way out? What's your third way out if your primary route is compromised? Practice it, do it, because when you're under stress, you're going to go to your default every time. I'm going to go out the way I always go because I know that's over there, but I'm not really sure how that works, where it works. So I'm going to go the way I normally go. And if that's compromised, so you shouldn't be comfortable on those other routes to know the way out. We're in a building here that has multiple exit routes, but if we were told to evacuate this minute, I can almost guarantee you, every one of you would go out the same way you came in, even though there's other exits closer to you. But you don't know where they are. You never tried that. You don't know what's on the other side of that door. So I don't know. But I know I came in that way, so I'm going to go back out, even though that may not be the best, safest way to go. Try your other routes. See what they like. Just run this fire this up again.
So we're at 6 hours and 527 acres burned.
Yeah, so 10 cities in a little risky situation right now. Pine Knolls is being impacted. All of East Village is impacted. Starting to get over here onto the east side, Lodge Hillside, the middle school is impacted. So this is a catastrophic fire for Cambria. Anybody disagree with that? And this is catastrophic. This is not Paradise. We're not trying to pretend that it is. But this is catastrophic right here. So our purpose is to avoid anything that even comes close to this. in the methods that we look at. How do we return the forest to a healthy condition? How do we prepare the public? How do we reduce fire intensity in locations that we have likelihood of fire ignitions, highway ignition, those kinds of things? Questions? Yes, sir. Question is, what's the relative risk to the community of San Simeon from a fire in Cambria? The main factor that's going to determine that is wind direction. So is the wind blowing from Cambria toward San Simeon? Then there's a risk. So you always remember, wind rules everything. Wind rules everything. It overpowers, it trumps every other fire behavior condition that there is, wind. So whatever direction the wind's going, that's where the fire's going. So if you are downwind of a fire, you're high risk. If you're upwind of a fire, you're much lower risk. You live in Santa Rosa Creek, you talk about those down canyon winds that occur. What happens right after that, though? They reverse. They go back up canyon again. So the winds never stay constant. They're always changing. So what fire managers know is to pay attention to the wind, what's happening right now, what would happen should that wind change, knowing that it will change. What's the likelihood it's going to change? What's the direction it's going to change? What's the velocity it's going to change? What's out ahead of that? So it's always it's a holistic 360 view of the problem set, keeping in context all of that. So we're probably way over time. So anyway, these are models. This is a pretty fascinating tool that we use, and then we can, you know, bring it back again other times. We have two of these in the county now that we got through grants, you know, to try to help educate people and kind of work with the emergency responders so they can kind of play with this as well to determine where would we deploy, you know, our law enforcement resources, where would we deploy other resources, you know, large animal rescue. People got horses. Who's going to come get the horses? So one last question, and then Dave's going to get the hook. Are we going to show you the chimney fire? We don't have that model set up, but that's a good question. We could do that. Had the chimney fire continued another day or two? You know, 6 miles away sounds like a lot. It's not that far. You know, from here. You know, that fire came down in behind Hearst Castle. Yeah, so it's not that far away. Remember, that's almost predominantly grassland, so fires move fast in grass. Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Okay, so Dave's getting the hook. Thank you.
Now are you afraid? All right, but more importantly, are you prepared? Okay, you know, they talk about how long is it going to take you to leave. Well, do you have a checklist that tells you to do this, 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 this before you go? And do you have your bag, your go bag, ready to go? Is it sitting there ready to go so that you don't have to worry about it? You just pick it up, throw it in the back of your car, you get in the car, and you go. And you take one car, leaves. So are you prepared to go? In the spring, we'll have another event, and we will talk a lot about are you prepared and how to be prepared and what you should be doing and should not be doing, okay? We'll make sure we cover that. But if you have other topics you would like us to cover in the spring, again, my email account, okay, or go out to Facebook and post something and say, hey, can you cover this on the next one in the spring? It'll be... I'm thinking late March, early April, okay? Again, if you would like to join us, please do. We need a lot more volunteers to help on the stuff that we do, including these kind of events. It's not a lot of work, but, you know, it's always helpful. Again, I would like to thank all of the speakers that we had and all of the exhibitors that came out and helped us out today. And, of course, AGP for doing a great job. Again, all of this information is going to be out there for you to view again, or better, to send to your friends, right, and neighbors, and ask them to view it, right? We want those people to be scared too. All right, thank you all for coming.